From mountain crest to mountain crest, from the canyon to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low and keeping you company tonight. It's Joshua P. Warren. Speaking of strange, we are the favorite program of hodags, wendigos, skunk apes, and little people. And I am Vance Pollock, bringing you the strangest, discussing the weirdest, and as they say, from the summit of man's wisdom to the pit of his dark depravity. But we'll save the depravity for next hour. This hour, let's talk. Let's go personal. I enjoyed that. We just kind of off the cuff last hour decided that we wanted to talk about the things that scared us. Shelley was on about mirrors.
Right.
And just as we went to break, I saw the light bulb pop over your head, and she was like, you remember that time we were over at Josh's house to watch the National Geographic documentary? They had shot a documentary about the Brown Mountain Lights, which the Lemur team had participated in. And when it aired on the Nat Geo channel, we all dropped by Joshua P. Warren's house to watch this National Geographic documentary. And he had recently acquired the mirror that Dr. Raymond Moody had used in his psychomantium research. We talked about the psychomantium being something of a sensory deprivation chamber that some people say they have used to communicate with the dead. Dr. Raymond Moody is the author of books such as Life After Life from 1975, in which he actually coined the term near-death experience.
Did he really?
Dr. Moody is responsible for the expression near-death experience from the book Life After Life, which I haven't read. He's got some others, Glimpses of Eternity, The Light Beyond, Reunions. I have read Reunions, Visionary Encounters with Departed Loved Ones. Life After Loss, The Last Laugh. Dr. Raymond Moody, and he lives down in Georgia, I believe. But anyway, Josh invited him up here for a conference in Asheville, and he gave a conference on the psychomantium how the psychomantium may be used as a therapeutic device.
Right.
And I think it might be. Some people lose loved ones with very little closure, and they have a hard time getting over that. And so, I mean, basically, that's what a spirit medium, that's what kept spiritualism in business for so many years, is the fact that there are people who really want to communicate with their departed loved ones. And maybe the psychomantium experiment is more auto-hypnosis or self-suggestion. I don't know the terminology or whatever, but it definitely gets inside your head, or can, for some people. But you were over at Josh's, and he showed you Raymond Moody's mirror. He talked Dr. Raymond Moody out of the mirror that he had used in his, and it was an old mirror. You could see that the black was kind of separating from the silver behind the glass. It was an older mirror.
Old mirror, big mirror.
Right.
And he was very proud of it. It was the first time I'd ever been to his house. And so he was showing me the mirror. And then we walked away from it. And a few minutes later, I walked back over to the mirror by myself. And it shoved me. It shoved me back. I don't know if anybody else saw it, but I remember walking over to Joshua and saying, "You got a rude mirror. It just shoved me." I guess it hadn't done that to anybody else. I don't know why it did it, but it physically shoved me.
There was a physical force that bumped you.
Yes, yes.
When you stood in front of that mirror by yourself.
Yeah, I have never had that happen before.
Did that scare you a little bit?
It just kind of took me back. I was just it was just rude. I was just taken aback. I wasn't scared.
Shelley doesn't seem like the sort of girl who would scare easily, so it's interesting when she will admit that something may have shaken her even a little bit. I don't know if something really scared you. I
kind
of have the feeling, oh, you might get defensive.
Yeah. If there is some chance of being startled by something, I might hit you.
Okay. Are you not like a jump scare movie fan? Do you not like the jump scares?
I don't like those. No, and I make fun of the I Know What You Did Last Summer movies, the ones with the movies where you've got a campground or a old house and somebody's killing people, but yet you've got the young, beautiful people undressing and having sex in these rooms or taking a bath or making themselves very, very vulnerable and eventually getting killed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I make fun of those.
I watched Sixth Sense for the first time.
That's
in
a
long time.
Scary
that,
movie.
I See Dead People.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even knowing the punchline, I won't ruin it for people. Maybe you haven't seen Sixth Sense. The movie came out in 1999. Is that hard to believe? That movie is
crazy.
18 years old.
That kid is now. Was that Haley? That was Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
He's got a successful career now. He's doing a lot of directing and acting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, on reviewing, even knowing the punchline, the movie was good, and it was, I was getting a little tearful watching Sixth Sense. But there are people who were not even born at the time that movie came out that it's time for them to watch that. I got that so that Sylvan could watch it with me. He's 12. I figured it's a good one for him. I think it's a PG-13.
It's still scary.
It is. It's very atmospheric, mm-hmm. very much about interactions with the dead. It's fascinating, and I think it might be the first or one of the first M. Night Shyamalama Ding Dong movies.
Back when he was good.
So.
Yeah. He did Signs. Did you like Signs very much?
I did like Signs, but I like Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense is really good.
Yeah.
And I'm going to watch Stir of Echoes. You like that one?
Scary.
Yeah.
So scary.
Okay. Stir of Echoes, Kevin Bacon.
That's the one with Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
Right.
What was the one with Denzel and John Goodman where it's like,
oh, wow. Yeah. I forgot. I was thinking about that the other day. That one's creepy where the spirit jumps from one person to the next and they start singing that. I can't remember. That was good. You're right.
But Stir of Echoes.
Stir of Echoes, Kevin Bacon. It's based on a Richard Matheson story. Richard Matheson was one of the writers for the original Twilight Zone television series. He died a few years ago. It was one of the later adaptations from one of the original Twilight Zone writers. And I thought it was really good. It looked good. It was kind of a B movie, but... again, it had spirit communication as a theme. Kevin Bacon goes to a party and gets hypnotized sort of as like a party joke. There's a lady there who's talking about the ability to use hypnotism, and he challenges her, says, I bet you can't hypnotize me, whatever. I may be getting this a little bit wrong, but I'm just going to set you up to go out and watch Stir of Echoes.
The name of that was Fallen, by the way.
Fallen is the one where they're singing Time is on My Side.
Yeah.
I needed to know that. Time.
Very creepy use of the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. So there's three good movie picks for you. Sixth Sense. We ought to do that every week. We ought to have a segment where we just throw around some classic horror movies. Sixth Sense, Stir of Echoes, The Fallen.
Just Fallen.
But Denzel Washington in Fallen. Okay, and where were we? We were talking about the Psychomantium a little bit, weren't we? Raymond Moody.
Right.
Joshua put me in a sort of a predicament over there. I was assisting with the Psychomantium experiments. He had most of us sit in the psychomantium that he had set up in the back of his house at that time for shorter or longer sessions. And when he put me in there in this dark room, I didn't realize it, but he had the yak skull. We called it the yak skull. I don't know if it was I think it was a deer skull that he had used on the altar in a scene from Inside the Church of Satan. Satan. Yes.
Right.
He had this goat skull on the bed in the same room or on the table over there, and I didn't even realize this, but after the fact, this was revealed, and Josh didn't seem too concerned that he may have introduced scary stuff, cursed items into the psychomantium atmosphere. But the fact is that I left the psychomantium that morning because this session took two parts. And by the time I left there the second time, I was very shaken. I was frightened. And I thought that what I saw in the psychomantium was something like a winged demon.
Really?
Yeah. I had an encounter with a demon in the psychomantium, and I had blacked out, which is strange. I don't pass out from drinking. I'm not saying that if you hang out with Joshua P. Warren till late in the morning that there won't be alcohol. There was, but I usually have a pretty good grip on my drink. I rarely touch the stuff anymore, but at the time I was pretty much in charge. But I blacked out in the psychomantium, and Josh and my friend Lee were in the front room and could hear me screaming.
You were screaming?
I was screaming inside the psychomantium, and they didn't come in there and get me. They didn't come and put a recorder. That's what my thought was. I wonder who I was yelling at or what I was screaming about, because Josh and Lee both said you were back there screaming and yelling, and I had blacked out and I didn't wake myself up, even though I was back there screaming in the psychomantium. One other thing I do remember about that session is that I thought their wiener dog, Lolly, was there in the room with me. Lolly was locked up in the room with Lauren, Josh's wife, on the other end of the house, but they had lost other Dachshunds. So it kind of plays into the pet ghost chapter where Josh talks about the spirits of wiener dogs. We'll be right back. Speaking of strange. Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Vance Pollock. You'll want to go by joshuapwarren.com and see what Josh is into. I heard he sold out that conference, that limited conference that he's giving down in Puerto Rico But that's going to be a fun one if you were one of those lucky 10 participants to reserve the time to go down for the Joshua P. Warren festivities. JoshuaPWarren.com. Parasymatics, we've talked about that recently. Josh has rendered some new magical sigils using the science of cymatics. And I just saw on social media, I haven't talked to Josh in a couple of weeks, but I just saw that he and Lauren were going into a casino. Lauren stared at the wealth sigil for 45 seconds and then walked up to a slot machine and hit the biggest jackpot she's ever hit.
I read that today. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Josh is prone to hyperbole, but I have to trust him on this one because it checks out. When Josh says something just that blunt, it's the truth. I believe him. He didn't say how much. He said the biggest jackpot she had ever hit. Now, I mean, what exactly? Joshua, I'm sure details will be forthcoming, but if she had only hit like $100 jackpot before, it wouldn't be super impressive to hit, walk up to a slot machine and pull $150 out of it, but still it would be fairly impressive. What are the odds of just walking up to a slot machine and hitting the jackpot?
Pretty high?
Yeah, well, they're not good. So I would have to say that staring at the wealth sigil, the parasymatic wealth sigil, can't have hurt her situation at all. JoshuaPWarren.com.
No period.
No period.
After the P.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about the Psychomantium experience and how I thought there was a doggy in the room, and it turned out it might have been a ghost doggy. That was weird, very bizarre. It's in a book. There are several chapters about the experiences because we had a good friend, Micah Hanks, who was hanging around at the time, and his first book is called Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. I don't know if it's out of print, but there are copies floating around. There are copies to be had, Amazon, wherever. Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule by our buddy Micah Hanks has a couple chapters where he details the Psychomantium experiments of that time period, and he interviewed me at length about my encounters with the winged demon. Well, I say it was, I didn't see a winged demon, but the mood, the feeling I got after my time in the Psychomantium, blacked out screaming, were like some Mothman type. Yeah, dark, monstrous beast. Yeah, it was not a positive experience for me, and it probably didn't help that we were all sitting around a Van de Graaff generator breathing electricity for a few minutes before I went back in there. And the way Micah had put it to Josh, you mean you just sent him back into the Psychomantium with his brain all exposed and quivering like that? And Josh said, yes, I suppose I did. Just see what might happen. Also, what kind of wanted to throw out a term that I've come up with recently, and I don't know if it's even accurate. There's probably a better term. I'm not working on coining a term or a expression as popular as the near-death experience, but I would like to talk about the believer experience. When you deal with people who are sold on the paranormal, I'm not saying that they're a pushover, that they'll buy everything that any of the reality TV shows are pitching, and a lot of the stuff is bunk. It's entertainment.
Watch your mouth, buddy. Jeez.
But for the people who are sold on the paranormal, and I count myself among them, even though I'm a skeptic of most other people's experiences, Because I think when you get in a group, if you were in a room full of people who all had these amazing paranormal experiences and you hadn't had any, you might even be prone to make up a good ghost story. So I don't even know the people who are running around. I don't know who to trust. I can trust Shelley. I can trust the young lady in the room with me here, and I can trust Sam because Sam doesn't care if he offends you or not.
Not really.
But I had an experience when I was a teenager that if anyone believes me, and I've told this story a dozen times one-on-one with people when I have the conversation about, whoa, wow, that microphone just swung away as if maybe you're not ready to reveal this story. It's a personal story that I tell one-on-one with people as I get to know them. And Shelley, you may have heard it about when I was in the house where I grew up, absolutely alone. My parents were up here in North Carolina. I was back home in Florida in a locked house, and I sat there in the living room reading a book and looked across the living room. There's a door that went into the bedroom where my grandmother had stayed. My grandmother's been dead since 1975. At this point, it's, say, 1990-ish. And that door has a table in front of it on the living room side and a desk in front of it on the bedroom side, because you can just walk into the hallway and come through the kitchen and into the living room. So that after my grandmother was gone, not staying there, she didn't need that door from the bedroom straight into the living room. So we just kind of put some furniture in front of the door and didn't use the door anymore. But I mean, that's just the little bungalow. The house I grew up in had this door from the living room to the bedroom that was never used. But I was sitting there late one night reading, and I don't know if I heard something or just glanced, but all of a sudden I'm watching the doorknob on this door turn very slowly and deliberately back and forth for about 10 seconds or so. And the hair stood up on the back of my neck and on my arms, goosebumps, right? And it took me a minute or two to compose myself enough to walk around through the kitchen into the hallway and open the door and flick the light on and look in that bedroom. And of course there was nothing there.
No.
If I had cameras set up on either side of that door, videotaping this doorknob turning by itself, and showed that as evidence, people would say, no, you faked it. That doesn't mean anything. You rigged that up. But I am telling you, and I'm telling, speaking of strange listeners, that I sat alone in a room and watched a doorknob turn by itself. And the first thought was, when I told my parents and family about that, they were like, well, was there like a
Sasquatch involved?
A Sasquatch. Was there an airplane breaking the sound barrier? Because have Chuck you ever Yeager. Been around? Because plane will shake the sound barrier and it'll rattle. But it wasn't like when the space shuttle was coming back in and it breaks the sound barrier and the glass and the windows rattle and things rattle. It wasn't a rattling effect. It was a very slow and deliberate effect, just like someone took hold of the doorknob and turned it.
Do everything, turn.
But I'm saying that is my believer experience. If I never see another example of anomalous behavior out in the world, we'll say that would have done it for me. And similar experiences may include a UFO experience. I was speaking to an aunt, and she said that she, two of her sisters-in-law, very no-nonsense sorts, were driving across the plains and witnessed a large mothership-type craft that they wouldn't talk to most people about, because most people would have thought they were absolutely insane. But here are two very well-educated, no-nonsense types who saw an alien craft in the sky. I mean, just think about the simplicity of things like my believer experience and witnessing UFOs, would it make a believer out of you? We'll talk a little bit more about the believer experience when we come back. This is Joshua P. Warren speaking of strange.
People don't change, that's all I know. You can go far, or you can go slow. Say that it's right, say it's for you. That doesn't change, what do I feel? Cause you can take away the honeymoon and stare into the sun. Or you can try.
Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, joined by investigator Shelley Wright and producer Sam the Animal Steele. I broached the subject of the believer experience. Shelley, you talked about ghostly things started to happen to you when you were just a wee lass.
Just, yeah.
And a lot of the stuff we talk about here is, it's just mind-blowingly synchronistic. It defies coincidence, but people might just accuse us of trying to make up a good story. I mean, it's all circumstantial, but if anyone believes me, if anyone could have sat there on the couch next to me that night and seen that doorknob turn, it would alter the way they look at reality. And don't you think that there are many non-believers out there that are just one experience away from a turnover in their worldview? Or do you think there are some people out there who would dismiss something like that, maybe even block it out? Because that's the way I spoke to a friend of mine whose mother attended seances when she was a teenager.
Really?
And she actually invited one of her high school friends along to a materializing seance back in the 1950s. And they witnessed in this seance, I've heard the tales of this medium. Her name was Bertie Lily Candler. She was named for the Candler family that Candler, North Carolina, just west of Asheville,
Candler Town,
is named for. Even though she grew up in East Tennessee, she's from that Candler family that were locals. Her parents from Madison County, I believe. But anyway, Bertie Lily Candler was one of the foremost materializing mediums in the middle 1900s. Before materializing mediums sort of dematerialized. But in the seance, my friend tells me that she saw things that were unmistakably and uncannily genuine phenomena, that she recognized dead people coming out of the medium's cabinet, that there's no impersonator, nobody dressing up, you know, wrapping gauze around their head or whatever and coming out into the dark room. But it was a low-lit environment, a red bulb usually used in this seance environment. But in the course of doing research on Bertie Lilly Candler, I knew this lady for some years because her father had been acquainted with some eccentric sorts here in Asheville, North Carolina, and I had tracked her down with no idea that some years later the name Bertie Lilly Candler would come up in conversation, that she knew Bertie Lilly, because when you talk about groups of strange people and you isolate them, within the geographical confines of these mountains, people who are interested in ghosts and UFOs and all that weird sort of stuff, it's like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon becomes like the 2 degrees of Joshua P. Warren. Everybody that knows Joshua P. Warren knows some people that we know in common. If you ever bump into people out in public they're like, oh, you're Shelley Wright. They've all got stories for you, and they all know, we have friends in common. But she tells me that she went to this Bertie Lilly Candler seance and took her high school friend, and that the things they saw in that seance, she was comfortable with because she had been brought up that way. Her father and mother had told her that this stuff is genuine, this is real, and that Bertie Lilly is a gifted materializing medium. So what we see in the seance is going to be genuine. So she never doubted it, and she never took issue with it. But her high school friend was almost traumatized by what she saw, and they never spoke of it. And some 40 or 50 years later, when she got back in touch with this woman she had gone to high school with, they were best friends in high school, and she mentioned that to her just in an offhanded way. Her friend was like, we don't talk about that.
Still, she was still traumatized?
Yeah. She had blocked out the idea of communicating with the spirits, even though what she had witnessed is, according to some historians or some authorities on spiritualism and mediumship, one of the greatest spirit mediums of all time. Of course, you're going to hear from people on the other side who say that she was a very good hoaxstress, etc. I don't know if I've ever heard that term before, hoaxstress, but you know what it means or would imply. But I spoke to another woman in the course of my research who says that her father had died. He had been robbed and murdered when she was a young girl. And when she was a teenager, she attended with her mother a Bertie Lilly Candler seance, and her father came out.
Wow.
And she stood, just a few feet away, as close as you and I, in that dark room, and could recognize her father's face. And another thing about it, no one else in that room besides she and her mother knew that her father was even dead. More or less what he looked like, had certainly never seen a photograph of him, but they're observing the face of her deceased father in this room in the dark. And she said one little clue that made it more vivid, more real than ever, is that my father, I remember from the time I was a child until I was 8 years old when he was murdered, when he got off from work, he didn't like a tight necktie. So the first thing he would do when he got out of work was put his fingers up there under that necktie and loosen the button on one side of his collar and pull that necktie off to the side. And she said the spirit, as it appeared to us in that seance, was my father with his necktie undone and pulled off to the side. And there is no way that anyone else in that room could have known that except me and my mother. But she said her deceased father stood in the ectoplasm right there in front of her.
Wow.
But like I say, on the other hand, I've got the experience of a high school friend who attended one of these very convincing seances and would never talk about it, totally blocked it out. So Shelley, do you care to talk about some of your early experiences with the spirits and what made a believer out of you?
You know, the first thing I remember was when I was four, and it was a Sunday afternoon car ride with my parents and my brother and grandmother. And my brother and grandmother and I were sitting in the back seat. And all I can remember is driving along this road, and there was a steep embankment. And I remember seeing this woman laid out on the side of a bank. And she wasn't wearing any clothes. And I remember, you know, when you're a kid, you just question things. You look at something and you try and make sense of it. And I remember she was laying there, and she was splayed out. I mean, and naked. And as a little 4-year old, I'm thinking, oh, well, she's just laying out in the sun. And then the next thought was, but it's cold outside, and you're just, it didn't last very long. Obviously, it made an impression on me. Nobody else in the car saw it. And then a few years later, I remember seeing a man standing in my room. I remember getting scared. I think I may have screamed and turned around. And then when I turned back around, he was gone. But he was tall and thin, and he was wearing a blue suit with what looked like a blue top hat on. I don't remember any facial features. I screamed to turn around. When I turned back, he's gone. But all through it, I still had feelings about things. I don't think that it was after I was 12 or so when I saw the man in the top hat. I just remember the experiences that I started having started speeding up. I was having a lot more of them in shorter periods of time, and just trying to find some kind of reason. What is going on? And I might be scared, but I'm still trying to think, well, logically, all right, what's happening here? What do I remember? What was I doing? And just kind of asking myself questions and working through it. And I did have some really crazy things. I remember one night I was laying in bed, and it was winter time, but it was a really hot, stuffy night in my room. And I remember I threw off all the covers, trying to get cooled off, and tucked him in beside me and the wall. And then I'm laying there like, okay, finally, I'm getting comfortable. And the covers pulled themselves back up over me and landed right at my neck. I didn't move a muscle the rest of the night. I didn't sleep in my room for 2 weeks after that. I was begging my brother's friend, please, please sleep on the other couch in the living room with me. I don't want to be by myself.
Wow. Early experiences that made believers out of us, would they make believers out of you? We'll continue after these messages. Speaking of strange.
Can't sing love songs. I wake your mother. She's sleeping there, right by your side. In her right hand, a silver dagger. She said that you can be my bride. Your daddy is a handsome devil. Chain 5 miles long. On every link, a heart has dangled of another woman. He's loved and wrong. Silver dagger, I fought in vain.
You're listening to Speaking of Strange on 570 WWNC. Drop by joshuapwarren.com. Drop by hauntedasheville.com. And drop by the Joshua P. Warren Mystery Museum Facebook page. I curate that Facebook page. Facebook.com/group/Mystery Museum. It's not all that busy, but occasionally I'll share links, usually local history stuff, weird stories. Occasionally I have to write a couple paragraphs myself because it's just not documented in very many places. Earlier this week I threw a link out about the 1916 flood, because it was an interview with a woman who was, I believe she was 17 years old at the time of the flood, and she lived in Biltmore Village, and her father was a superintendent or caretaker on the Biltmore estate, and he tried to lead two of his daughters and a couple other girls who were rooming with him across the bridge just as the water was rising, and he got across the bridge into the village. They were actually on the corner. Their house was right on the corner about where the Wendy's is in Biltmore Village now. He managed to get across the bridge with them and down towards All Souls, trying to get to higher ground. But if you've ever seen the Swannanoa out of its banks in Biltmore Village,
oh man, I've seen cars floating upside down.
It's a mess. In 2017, it got some of the trees in front of the All Souls Church.
This year?
The water level. No, this is in 1916. This is a big flood, 1916. And the water level in front of All Souls Church got like 8 or 9 foot up the trees in front of where All Souls Church
is. Was it 99, 2000, when that big flood, somewhere in the late 90s maybe? Or was it in the early 2000s where, like, the liquor store where it was in Biltmore Village? I mean, that was all the way up to the ceiling.
I've seen it underwater as recently as 2006 or 8, I think. Everything there. Like Osaka, the little Japanese, greasy Japanese restaurant there was underwater.
Yeah.
Anyway, J.C. Leip was this gentleman's name, and he led his daughters and a couple of girls who were rooming with the family across the bridge into the village, and they were making their way. You know, the water is up to their waist now, and he's holding the youngest girl, and they make it onto the church lawn, and he actually shoves those girls up in a tree. So they're up in the tree branches, and he climbs up underneath them and clutches on them, you know, a death grip around. He's hugging these girls to this tree, and the water is still rising.
Oh, that's scary.
And eventually, he's hung there for several hours, and he tries pushing the girls up there and tying one of the girls up there, either with his lashing her to the tree with his belt or something like that, and he's just wore out. The water is rushing and pounding against him. I mean, just shoving him, and he's holding onto this tree, and he's got those girls up in the tree, and he says, "Girls, I'm wore out. I can't stay. I can't hang on any longer."
Listen to this.
He gets washed away.
This statistic. In that 1916 flood, a weather station measured 22.2 inches of rain from 2 p.m. on July 15th to 2 p.m. on July 16th.
Good
and
Lord.
At the time, that was the U.S. record for the most rainfall within 24 hours, and that held for many years until it got passed not very long ago, but it still holds a statewide record for the 22.2 inches in 24 hours.
Nearly 2 feet of rain in a 24-hour period.
And that's not to account over, before that, it was 5 to 20 inches on the days before that. So you're looking at over 40 inches
what I was wanting to get at, and I'll just kind of throw it out there on the end. The thing is, after J.C. Leip was washed away, one of the other daughters fell away. The two girls they were staying with, that were staying with them, fell away. The one daughter, the 17-year-old daughter Kathleen, managed to hold on for 9 hours up in that tree. She survived. She had a daughter by the name of Betty, who married, and as Betty Brock, the granddaughter of this man, J.C. Leip, who washed away in the 1916 flood, wrote two children's novels that were very well received and changed a lot of lives. I mean, children's literature is very inspirational. I'm learning that more as I'm starting to work in the libraries around here. I'm rekindling my appreciation for children's literature. Betty Brock wrote No Flying in the House and a book called The Shades that were very influential. Both of those books published about 1970. Had her grandfather not pushed her mother up in that tree, those are two books that wouldn't exist. So No Flying in the House and The Shades by Betty Brock. Put those on your must-read list. That's it for Hour 2. Dark 30 coming right up. Speaking of strange.